to an episode of Torah Podcast. Today on the podcast, we got Nick Salas.
What's up, what's up?
Co-owner of Movement Art.
That's me, Black Belt under Mikey Musumeci. Yeah, dude, thank you for having me on here. Super excited. Dude,
thank you for coming.
The conversations we're going to have today. Already starting off with a little bit of caffeine.
Caffeine is like a staple in your diet, huh?
Oh, dude, it is my diet.
It is your diet.
So you always start off the day with, you know, a nice coffee, and you work your way up to energy drinks, and then you taper back down to coffee. So by around midday, you're on the energy drinks, and then when you need that pick-me-up around like 6, 7 p.m., maybe a little, you know, nightcap at around 10 p.m., you end the day with coffee.
Most of my days are like, you know, regular one cup of coffee, maybe two tops, right? And then like I'll have like maybe an energy drink.
Yeah.
Like midday to afternoon, right? So that's it, right? But when I go to the office, we have like a fridge full of like anything you want, right?
All types of energy drinks.
Energy drinks, Coke, whatever you want, right? Like I don't drink soda, but like I'll take a Red Bull. I'll take a Lock
Alarm. Yeah, because it's like a habit at that point. Yeah, it's right there. It's so right easy there. To access. Yeah.
So it's like my day starts with like coffee, more coffee. Dude, then like grab like an ice, like
Lock Alarm. For me, dude, that's dangerous.
Dude, it's so dangerous.
Like the barrier for me is I have to go to Wawa to get the energy drink. And sometimes, you know, if I'm being lazy, you know, I'll find an alternative method. But if I had a fridge fully accessible with all these drinks,
dude,
we're looking at dangerous numbers. So I guess my question for you, since most regulatory bodies say that around 400 milligrams of caffeine is like where you should cap it off at. Once you pass that 400, which it sounds like you're doing, why not just go full send? Like, why stop at, you know, one energy drink? Why not drink two?
Dude,
drink
three? You just, like, I'm going to snap next time I'm in the office and I leave the office. I'll snap a picture of my trash can because it's like coffee, two Red Bulls, one Monster. Like, it's ridiculous. But it's like I'm on such a high there and I'm just like.
So then people at the gym are always criticizing me. They're like, man, like you drink too many energy drinks. But my answer to them is once you drink two, who cares at that point? You know, what's the difference between three and seven?
Heart attack, but that's like.
True. But hey, you know, sometimes you got to fly close to the sun.
Yeah. And
sometimes you get burned, sometimes you don't. But I feel like once you're in that lifestyle, it's just hard to go back, you know? So dude, this is like.
People judge me so hard. Like, over there. Like, that's not my regular routine, but like, it's so accessible that I'm just like. The
thing for me, I try to explain to people is like, I don't even get like a stimulatory effect from it. I think what it does is it just prevents me from going below the threshold of normal.
Mm-hmm.
So like when I wake up, I'm groggy, you know, I have brain fog. And so I feel like caffeine for me just allows me to function as a normal like human being. And then it just reaches a threshold where if I drink one, if I drink five, there's really no like excess effect thereafter. It's just like I'm just stuck in like functioning, which for me is good
because
I just want to be functioning all day. But I guess for some people they project how caffeine makes them feel onto me, so they're like, dude, you're crazy, three cans, four cans, like I'll be dying if I did it. And I'm like, dude, it's for me literally there's no difference. And
the only one that makes me feel different is C4. So C4,
That's why you're staying away from this.
It literally, like, my skin starts tingling. And I'm like, man, this is...
Bad idea. Especially if you're doing jiu-jitsu, you don't want to feel like that.
Your whole skin just, like, starts tingling. And I was like, oh, man.
Dude, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could make an argument that, you know, some people say that's the beta-alanine, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think... So I looked into it. And it could be one of two things for me. It could be that I'm a super metabolizer when it comes to caffeine, which just means that the rate at which my body's metabolizing the caffeine, it's almost out of my system before I get those extra effects, plausible. Or I have what's called like a paradoxical effect, which is when I drink caffeine, it calms me down. And that calming effect is what I attribute to feeling normal.
Yeah.
Because I have ADHD. So maybe when I drink caffeine, it's functioning almost like a therapeutic Adderall, where it's bringing me down instead of, you know, being high strung or, you know, having my brain work at like a million miles an hour. So yeah, those are the two theories I'm operating under. It could be even both, who knows? But yeah, I don't know, man. It's a lifestyle.
Have you ever played around with like the waiting 2 hours to drink caffeine?
The Andrew Huberman?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, I can't. That's just two hours of droggy.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, no, it's like, and then there's, so I do try to wait 30 minutes because I do feel like having to drink caffeine as soon as you wake up is almost like you, it's just embarrassing at that point. Like you really can't just use the bathroom without drinking coffee, you know, like basic waking up things, like brushing your teeth. So I choose to do like little tasks like that, you know, obviously without my caffeine. But as soon as I'm ready to take on a day, you know, I start every day journaling, writing down notes, whether it's for myself or it's for the lesson plan that I'm going to be teaching that day. I like to do that after coffee. So
okay,
that's like my routine for the morning. So, you know, wake up, brush my teeth, you know, I'm not caffeinated. But as soon as we're able to take on like the responsibilities of the day, coffee is on, you know, or whatever else. I've been doing like ginkgo.
Okay.
Which isn't like supposedly it's supposed to supply your brain with more oxygen. I'll do that. I'll do acetyl L-carnitine, which if you're fasting, it's supposed to give you more energy. I do ashwagandha, which is like something that's supposed to lower cortisol. And if you lower cortisol, your brain functions better. So I do other things on top of the coffee that's supposed to, for a lack of better term, stimulate you.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's like my morning routine.
Mine's more like wake up 5:45, somewhere around there.
That's crazy.
Wake the kid up, you know, he gets ready on his own. I put on a pod for mate, and I have mate like in the morning. So,
dude, mate is something I need to get into.
Dude, it's so good.
So
it's a great kind of like not just for the, it has a little bit of caffeine in it, but it's more like for me, the appetite suppression has been, you know, really, really good for that.
Mm.
Especially fasting like from, you know, 4 p.m. the previous day or whatever.
How long are you fasting? Like, are you doing?
I'm not counting, but yeah, like whatever, 4 p.m. to maybe 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And sometimes have breakfast, sometimes don't, sometimes, you know, one meal a day.
Yeah.
So it's not consistent.
I did my,
but it's been working for me.
It's funny you mentioned that because I did you know, the ancestry DNA test.
Yeah.
And I had like 3% Andean indigenous.
Yeah.
And then around 3%, a couple percent of I think what would be the analogous of like an Amazonian indigenous tribe. And so I have roughly around 5% indigenous blood. So I was like, man, I should get into mate to connect with my ancestors. That's just my excuse to.
My parents drink it every single day.
Yeah.
Like it's like a ritual for them to just wake up
and have, and then it. You have the straw, the metal straw.
Yeah, I have the whole setup and all. Yeah. But yeah, like, and then in the summertime is in Paraguay we drink tereré, which is the same thing but just cold. So it's really, really cool.
Yeah.
So that one is like great because you're just drinking so much water at that point. You're drinking a whole thermos. Mm. You know, just
what do you think about that whole you know, coffee or whatever it is dehydrates you?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah,
it's water, right?
Okay, I'm glad we're on the same page with that because that is one of my biggest pet peeves. I'm drinking a big gulp of coffee,
yeah,
and someone has to be like, you know, you're dehydrating. I'm like, what do you mean this is a gallon of coffee? There's no way I'm dehydrated, bro. That's not how it works.
The meme, actually?
Yeah, actually. Meanwhile, this person's drinking no water, no coffee.
Right?
I'm like, I think I'm more hydrated than you, bro. But I'm glad we're on the same page for that.
That's the thing. Like anything we're doing sometimes, it's like you're always going to have critics no matter what you do, right?
Yeah.
Like with me and, just to introduce for people who don't know, you're my coach and you're Culinary Movement R, black belt jiu-jitsu. So doing jiu-jitsu and people finding out about it and all this stuff, like I get some, you know, comments of like, you're going to get hurt. You know, that's not healthy for you. This and that. And it's like the worst thing in the world was this guy who was like you know, 400 pounds and lecturing me on how unhealthy it is to do this because I was limping one day of like, you know, like, and it was like, I'm just sitting there like, how do I,
yeah, like, how do you,
like, it's like, I don't want to be that guy, but like at the same time, man, like, come on, like, I'd rather be limping than, you know, looking like that. But like,
yeah, like, what's the alternative? Man. Like, I feel like anything that betters you is gonna be tough on you, and it's, you know, is the idea that you know, pain, you know, makes you stronger. I feel like to use that as like a justification to not do something.
Yeah.
Like, what is the deeper implication? Or is this person just sitting on their couch not doing anything? Because anything you do in life that's worth achieving is going to be difficult by definition, yeah, right? Otherwise, everyone would have it. So be it fitness, be it you're highly skilled in jiu-jitsu itself, be it muscle building, I don't care. Whatever thing you're doing that betters you is going to be difficult to an extent. So the reasoning that, you know, this is unhealthy for you, like, bro, let's weigh the pros and cons, right? Okay, maybe, you know, you got caught in a submission, you didn't tap in time, maybe you just rolled over your ankle, like whatever the case would be. I think the cons of that are significantly outweighed by all the benefits of jiu-jitsu, right? Like whether it's weight loss, whether it's mental stimulation, whether it's just through the mental adversity that you're, you know, exposed to every day on the mats, having to problem solve, having to, you know, become tougher in the sense that, you know, we all become tougher when someone's smothering us and, you know, we're met with the decision of, you know, are we going to tap to pressure? Or are we just going to try to, you know, tolerate this as much as we can until we're able to get out of the situation, right? That act makes you tougher. It makes you more resilient.
Yeah.
So whatever the reason is, like, all those things have benefits that outweigh the possibility of you hurting yourself. So, yeah, and that's,
dude. But even if it's like, you know, you're the, like, all of us, I mean, mm-hmm. like, I'm not going to be world champion. I don't think I will. Right. But like,
maybe,
but you never know. Right. That's not in the goals right now for me. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like most hobbyists, most people who just like come in maybe like 2-3 times a week, right. Getting out there moving. That's way better. That's like, 100%. To me is like, you know, like even if you don't do jiu-jitsu, even if you choose whatever thing to get out there.
CrossFit, because tennis.
You know, like especially working in a field where, you know, you're using your brains a lot. Mm-hmm. There was a saying that I really love. It was like, when we work with our minds, we have to relax with our hands. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like that thing. It's like, okay, I got to put away, even though jiu-jitsu is like brain workout too. Brain,
it works the other way. You know, I know a lot of guys that work with their hands.
Yeah.
And jiu-jitsu is kind of like a break away from the physical rigor. And that's where you see a lot of people take to the mental aspect of it.
Yeah.
I don't know, dude. I think people are going to make excuses for themselves, regardless of what it is, so that they can justify their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I'm not going to demonize someone for wanting to be 400 pounds and for wanting to watch Netflix all day. That's their
decision. But just don't come and lecture me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all I'm saying. I don't care. You can do what you. Exactly. I just want to do me, right? Like, it's like, man.
But do you think it's kind of like that idea of like, you know, misery enjoys company?
Mm.
So it's like this idea, like he can't do that for himself. So he kind of wants to pull you into his side of the fence. And
he's definitely that personality.
Have you suffer with him.
Yeah. And everything else. So like, man. Yeah. All right.
Give him a business card. All right. If you want to come to practice, come to practice.
Just one of those things that, you know, you look at them and you just nod your head and you walk away. You know,
what would you say is like the thing about jiu-jitsu you enjoy the most? Because, you know, you just did like a video testimonial for us, mm-hmm. that Sean, who's working with us, doing a tremendous job with our marketing and everything. And you were one of the first testimonials he posted. And you said a lot of great things about jiu-jitsu. You said you gave reasons to why, you know, you came to try it in the first place. You gave reasons to, you know, what kept you there and continuing your journey with jiu-jitsu, things mm-hmm. that you enjoy. But if you had to, like, give one main reason, right, if you had to reduce it down to like the most important one, what would you say that is?
It's kind of a cliche answer in some ways, but I really like the fact that I can lock in to this one thing and forget everything else in life. Mm. You know, my life gets split into like 50 different ways. Mm. So I'm a husband, I'm a father, you know, I volunteer for the kids, like, scouts. I'm a professional. I can get calls in the middle of the night and I have to respond to it. It doesn't happen often, but like those kind of things where like, I'm like every single second of my day is almost accounted for. Right. So that hour, 2 hours, whatever I get to go train is like, man, I can put everything away, yeah. Focus on this one thing and just do that. Mm.
That's actually really interesting you say that. And you're saying this as I'm looking at the Memento Mori board. And I think one thing I've been trying to do a lot more in my life is kind of integrate practices of like mindfulness, like you're mm-hmm. saying, into my life. And jiu-jitsu being like the main one, and then like also supplementing that with other avenues. So like, you know, just using the board and thinking about like my life from the lens of like, you know, mortality of like, man, mm-hmm. I have to make this day count, you know,
meditation, right?
Like, yeah, it's like a death meditation. I've been like doing stoic journalism, you know, I've been practicing mindfulness. Actually, funny story, just in Portugal, you know, Manny. Manny was there with us, and Manny's gotten, I'm sure he doesn't care, but he got really into breath work.
Yeah.
And I never really read into it, but I've heard of the benefits. I just, for whatever reason, never was curious enough to try it. But here I am with Manny, and he is talking about it with me, and he convinces me to try it. He's like, let's do some breath work right now. This was after the tournament. I already had competed. We had some spare time. I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. So he puts on a guided meditation, and I don't know how long it was. It felt like maybe, you know, 5 minutes. But basically, we're being guided on how to breathe. And Manny has me positioned on my back because he's like, you're a beginner. He basically says you're a white belt, so I'm going to have you be on your back. This is how people start. I'm like, okay, I don't know what that means, but all right. So I'm lying on my back. I'm doing the guided meditation, and Manny's to my right. He's sitting up kind of like you are, but on the floor, and he's doing the guided meditation that I'm doing, but seated. So we're doing this, and as I'm doing the breath work, I'm feeling kind of like tingling sensation in my body. And this is maybe a couple minutes in, and I'm feeling like electricity kind of like pins and needles. I'm like, all right, this is really weird. And I'm feeling a little lightheaded. And towards the end of the meditation, I hear like a doof. And I'm like, what? And I finish. Like, the guy is still telling us to breathe. So I'm like, I'm just going to keep breathing, whatever. I hear Kirk, who's doing homework on the dining room table behind us, laughing. Are you okay? All right, guided meditation's over. I look over. Manny's on the floor. Apparently, he passed out. And that's why Kirk was concerned. And he wakes up. He's like, bro, did you see that? I was like, no, because I was doing the guided meditation as well. He's like, dude, I passed out. And I'm like, is that why you had me lying down? He's like, yeah, dude. And I'm like, what the heck? But...
So what if you don't mind me, what is the goal of these breath?
So short story short, you know, we all had a laugh about that. But when I sat up, I've never thought so clearly before. I guess essentially what you're doing is like over oxygenizing your brain.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really looked into the science of it, but everything is just so bright. And everything is just so pure. You can feel the vibration of your voice through your like esophagus, through your mouth. And it's almost like what I would compare it to is like you're buzzed off oxygen. But what I was able to do was focus on a very like simple task of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And like you're saying, for those 5 minutes, whatever it was, I didn't think about anything other than breathing. And so regardless of how I was feeling, this is after my match, I was disappointed in my performance. You know, you work so hard to, to prep for a competition like that and to lose first round. You just feel like a total loser.
Dude, right? Story of my life.
But yeah. Yeah. Mine too, apparently. And, you know, a bunch of things going through your brain. But for those 5 minutes, I was just focusing on breathing. Hmm. And it's, I think for me, what's crazy is that, you know, I'm 29 years old. I've gone 29 years never thinking about breathing, which after you do the breath work sounds crazy because you're like, what is the one thing that you do all the time?
You breathe.
You breathe.
Have you ever read the book, Breath?
No. But I know you were super into like mouth taping. I think that's related, yeah. Right? Yeah. So we all breathe the same way, like we all drink water, we all sleep. Why don't we ever just think about breathing, which seems like such an obvious thing? And here I am in Portugal being guided by Manny to do something that I think would be intuitive, that I think everyone would do and should do. And so I think like going forward, I find myself implementing these things into my life so that I can enjoy my life more. So jiu-jitsu, right? You practice mindfulness as a consequence of, you know, having someone in front of you trying to choke you.
Yep.
You know, memento mori, you know, death meditations, you constantly reflect on your life and thinking about what that means to you. And now breath work, something hopefully that I can explore a little bit more and integrate into my life, is, you know, focusing on something so simple, so crucial to your existence, and giving it the respect that it probably deserves. Yeah. And through doing that, you acquire benefits like, you know, heightened, you know,
sensitivity
to the world.
Even resting. So yeah. I don't know if you ever heard of yoga nidra.
Yes. Yeah. Andrew Huberman talks about it a lot. Again, yeah.
Right. But.
But again,
that helps me so much. Yeah. Like there's times where I really need it. Like, you know, I can put on the headphones, go through a guided meditation, but the first thing you do in yoga nidra is take 2 breaths in and breathe out through your mouth. Mm. And that motion of like, just like kind of like lets you sink it all in.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah. You know, and then you go through that guided meditation, yeah, of relaxing, yeah, everything.
And that's the breath. It's just that. Yeah. And then you alternate that with, and then you do breath holds. And yeah, it's exactly how you, yeah. And it's like you're focusing on the movement of air. Mm-hmm. Through your nose, in your lungs, you know, and it's remarkable. It's just something I've always, taken, yeah, for granted, like just the sensation of oxygen, of air in your lungs. Like I never focused on that, right?
So when I first met my wife, we used to do a lot of like Tuesdays, go to a friend's house, meditate there, you know, actually like sit down, mm-hmm, and meditate. And then maybe Saturdays we would go down to like a Thai temple, mm-hmm, and go meditate there. And sometimes they'll do like this walking meditation. And imagine like half an hour spending going from this side of the room to that side of the room. Mm. It's like another thing, right? Like, yeah, it's like, oh, we're going to focus on every pressure, mm, of the foot, mm-hmm, going down to the middle of the foot.
That's amazing.
To the side. And it's like, you know, that mm, whole thing is like, it's like you think it's so stupid. You think so, but it's like there's so much focus into this one thing, mm-hmm, that your whole, like your brain goes from, it's like, oh my God, this is kind of difficult. Okay. You know, and it starts to calm down.
And it's such a pure experience.
Yeah.
Because like you're not overloading your brain with all this sensory information. Like, especially nowadays with social media,
mm-hmm,
I feel like everyone is like literally on edge all the time because we're giving our brain all this information that it's not naturally designed to do so.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, walk. So it's funny you mentioned that because, like, after the breathwork thing, I went, like, Reddit deep dive on what this means.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, there's, like, a whole slew of ways you can practice mindfulness. There's walking meditations. There's, you know, the idea of, like, when you eat food, like, really focus on the flavors and really hone in on how your taste buds are interacting with every bite. And so really, it's just the idea of appreciating all aspects of existence and giving it its right time and place. And I think if you just, you know, get in the habit of doing that, whether it's in the morning or whether, you know, you break it up into, you know, routines throughout the week, mm-hmm, like it's so easy. It doesn't take time to just do that, you know?
So. Yeah. That's so I've had guests here that ask me like, how do you do all this, mm-hmm. right? Because it's like, you do archery, you do this, yeah. you do jiu-jitsu. It's like, dude, it doesn't take that long. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I mean, like, yeah, jiu-jitsu, it's a big commitment, I mm-hmm. think. And but, like really, like, to get a lot of stuff done, if you really prioritize, it doesn't take that long.
I'm like almost positive if you looked at those people's phones, like if you looked at the screen time like numbers in their phones, you would see that they're all on their phones like 2 to 4 hours a day easy. So you're telling me you can't trade that time off for yeah. any one of these activities that take 5 minutes? I mean, besides for jiu-jitsu, right? But like everything else, it doesn't require that much time to yeah. do. So
no, I really believe in that. That's like one thing that's like it, prioritizing your, you know, your top things that you want to accomplish, you know, whether in today or your month mm-hmm. or, you know, the year.
Do you do that? Do you, so I'm assuming you journal or you do some sort of,
I do like... something different. Okay. It comes from this book called, Getting Things Done.
Mm-hmm.
And in Getting Things Done, I mean, mostly for work, I have like notepads and different notepads. We use something called OneNote, but there's like different tabs for everything. There's like project tabs, there's daily task, there's like waiting for stuff. Mm. There, like how to, like it allows me, and I also kind of have this ADHD brain where, you know, like my mind just gets ripped away everywhere. So it's like, especially if it's shiny and new, it's like, mm-hmm. ooh, I want to work on that, right? Like, I get yeah. so sucked into that's like, I have to like be like, no, there's deadlines involved. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, and in life too, right? But it helps me organize that whole process of like intaking information, mm-hmm. writing it down, and getting to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things that I just organize it in a way that's like, well, I have to follow the process. Mm-hmm. If I follow the process, I am productive,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Do you struggle, well, because I don't want to assume anything, but do mm-hmm. you struggle with, like, executive functioning? Because for me, right, so I try to make the priority list, the whatever you want to mm-hmm. call it, the tier list, and the problem is I can make the list, but when I go to execute those things in order of importance, I get distracted.
See, that's the problem. Like yeah. in the book, it, uh-huh. it explains, right? Like the list has to be done in a way that it always follows. You have to take the top priority. You have to take the mm-hmm. top thing on the list, whether it takes 2 minutes, 2 hours and all this stuff. So it's different than project work. Mm-hmm. Project work, imagine like for you, it could be like, my project work would be creating a curriculum and all that stuff for the month of, you know, February,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's project work, right? It's like, so then you start breaking it down. And it's like, what does that mean? Well, there's gi classes, no gi mm-hmm. classes, you know, and all that stuff. There's, you know, the historical thing. What does it tie into, right? So then you can start breaking it down into smaller and smaller pieces, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times what we do, especially... you know, in my brain is I have a big hairy goal. Mm-hmm. I want to accomplish this. But if I start looking at that, my brain goes, that's too big for me to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And you get paralysis.
And I get like, I don't want to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. So I want to put it away and I want to do something yeah. quick and easy that gives me that dopamine of like,
yeah.
I did this. Right. Yeah. So really, like if it gets too big, that goes into project work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And project work is like where I can say, okay, jobs to get all this done, right? If I want to accomplish this, what does it mean to accomplish this? What are all the, if you will, acceptance criteria of what this means to get done?
Mm-hmm.
And it means like I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to share with the team, I have mm-hmm. to, everything that involves doing that, right? And it's like, okay, that's broken down. What are next steps? Okay, next steps to accomplish that one piece.
Wow.
So then it starts breaking it down in a way that I'm like, I can calm down.
Even, it's manageable.
Like, even stuff around the house, it's like, I start spreadsheets of like, we just did our kitchen, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, you want to do the kitchen? And my heart starts palpitating. Yeah. It's like, oh my God, that's a lot of work.
That's a lot.
It's like, I'm not doing the work. Yeah. I'm hiring somebody to. Yeah. But like in my head, it's like, I start getting anxiety. I start getting like all
I'm
this stuff.
The
like,
same way, yeah.
Yeah. So my wife just walked in today and she's like, don't freak out, but I'm going to have somebody come out and look at this other thing.
But then you feel like you have to manage it. You have to overlook what's going on. It's also the resources that you're going to be spending on it.
100%. So it's like in my head, it's like I have this project work that I have to like break it down into smaller pieces. And we can go through my notes, but like it's all in there. Like, what does it mean to go? It's like, well, we need a microwave. Yeah. We need tiles. We need this. We need that.
Otherwise, it just creates anxieties if you keep just pushing it off.
It is like, so
then we're the crippling. Same. Where like if I have a task or if I have a project, my brain won't concede unless I understand all of the details that are going into it. Mm-hmm. If there's like something left unknown, like a stone unturned, it just creates anxieties. So this is probably the first time I'm going to go public with this. So this is a little exclusive information on this podcast. And I've been trying to think of ways that I could use this to help or integrate it into my overall goals of helping people through jiu-jitsu. But last year I was diagnosed with OCD. So my whole life, I knew I had ADHD, and then, you know, things for me got, you know, very heavy in terms of, like, how to manage my day-to-day tasks, like we're talking about right now. So I was like, all right, let me go and seek help. So I went to a neuropsychologist, and I got interviewed, and he basically says, let's just do, I know you were diagnosed with ADHD, but let's do further assessments. You're an adult now. You know, let's just see if anything has changed, whatever. So, you know, I do the collateral interviews, which means you bring in people. So I brought in Amina, he spoke to her, you fill out questionnaires, and then you do like the actual tests, right? Mm-hmm. And the tests are just like a bunch of like, you know, random tasks that you do, nothing interesting. And then at the end, they take all that information and then they compile that information and give you a diagnosis. I go back and he says, I have, you know, news for you. And depending on, you know, how you see this, it could be good news or it could be bad news. Right. So basically my new diagnosis is ADHD with OCD. Mm-hmm. The reason that would be good is because a lot of these doubts that you were having that kind of were outside of the mold of ADHD now are being accounted for, and now you have an answer for. So it's not just like these lingering things that like you're just like, man, is this just a personality thing? Is this whatever, right? The bad news is that, you know, OCD unfortunately doesn't have the same, you know, therapies or same options to deal with as ADHD does, right? But basically, like, for me, the things that stop me from getting those tasks done is a lot of these internal mental compulsions. And so what I'm finding is that I'm tackling these obstacles that previously I thought were just ADHD, right? Like lack of focus. I'm realizing that it's actually me wrestling myself in my own head, right? And the best way I can describe that is, you know, it's one thing for you to lose focus or to get distracted, and then it's another thing you find yourself over researching something, because if you don't research for 4 hours, you're gonna not be able to sleep at night because you just feel like something's wrong. And so for me, I'm happy that I finally understand like what's wrong with me mentally, but obviously it raises the bar for like how I'm going to approach these problems going forward. So I feel like you have a lot of good information, so I'm definitely going to pick your brain. But one of the things that I wanted to get your thought on this is like, if I have something to do that day that's important, right? But say there's like time constraints on it. So it's like it's something I have to do at this particular time, so 3 p.m. All that day up to 3 p.m. is just me thinking about that thing. So I guess my question to you is like, how in that situation, maybe you have the answer, maybe you don't, maybe you have an idea.
I have the same problem. Okay,
great. Yeah. Because I struggle with this. What do you do? You have a list. You have to get all these things done. What do you do to be productive until 3 p.m.? Knowing that, you know, your brain is like, no, let me know once you find the answer. Yeah, you can't do anything until this 3 p.m. thing is out of the way, you know.
Oh, dude, you have no idea. I mean, I get like that over certain, I wouldn't say all the time, mm-hmm. but like there's obviously I'm used to more with my work, you know, that forces me to do the time management and everything like that, right? Everything scheduled into meetings, everything. The only thing that I can do on like the notes side of it, mm-hmm. in the daily task, there's a column there for like waiting for. And it's like things that are out of my control that I cannot, you know, that I'm waiting for in order to accomplish something. And that helps me kind of like basically box it in and say, okay, it's sort of taken care of, mm-hmm. because every time I open my notes, it's like right there, like I'm still waiting for this. Mm-hmm. I'm still waiting for this, right? So it that could be mm-hmm. something that might or might not help.
Yeah.
But at least like in you know how like ADHD mm-hmm. people, right? Like we need piles, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And so, doom piles. Yeah, the doom piles, right? But like in some ways, it becomes hopefully not a doom pile, yeah. but something that I can put it into a pile mm-hmm. that's out of my control, but I know every time I look at it, it's going to be there, mm-hmm. right? So it allows me to say,
that's interesting.
I'm not taking care of that right now because I'm waiting for that. Mm-hmm. That's outside of my control. Mm-hmm. So that could help.
No,
but like I totally get anxiety over like
the focus is reducing anxiety in that case, which makes sense to me. So it's almost more of a functional approach to dealing with the weight. So no, I'm definitely going to take notes on that. But it's interesting.
For me, it's like, you know, like there are certain things like traveling. Mm. I don't care how early we are to the airport. I don't care how, I just get anxiety over traveling and everything like that. It's like, we talked about this, like mm-hmm. I have to be the guy who's like, goes through security, mm-hmm. looks at the gate mm-hmm. and is like, it's there. Mm-hmm. And then I can there. Like relax yeah. and stuff.
No,
like.
I'm the same way. It's irrational.
It is. But it's totally irrational.
Yeah. And when we understand that, we're aware of it, but we will not relax until we do that thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, it's maybe harder for some people to understand that, but this is an interesting topic. So, what do you think is the relationship between jujitsu and neurodivergence, if there is any? Because the joke in jujitsu, right, is that if you want to be good at jujitsu, you have two options. The best
are be autistic, right?
Yeah. Steroids are autism.
And if you have a little bit of both, then.
And if you have both, you're basically a superhero, right? But, you know, all jokes aside, what do you think that relationship is? Do you think it's, you know, is it that neurodivergent people feel like they have a place where, you know, they can maybe lean into to what society would deem weaknesses, but jujitsu so just happens to allow those weaknesses to present themselves as strengths in this sport.
So go further on that, like,
okay,
unravel that. So because what weaknesses are strengths in jujitsu?
I'll give you an example. So for example, hyperfixation, mm-hmm. right? I think that's like an easy one. I think that's very intuitive for people to understand, because I think, you know, obviously there's a difference between diagnosed hyperfixation and just like this hyperfixation that everyone experiences with things that they like. But in society, if you're hyperfixated on things that take your attention away from the things that you have to do, that's a weakness, mm-hmm. right? So if you're an employee and you're supposed to, you know, do your job, but you're hyperfixated on this other thing, that's a weakness, because your employer is going to look at you as being unproductive. But in jujitsu, you know, if your hyperfixations align with the tasks that are required of you in jujitsu, then it's almost like a superpower, because jujitsu is something that does require, mm-hmm. I feel like, a lot of like cognitive investment and physical investment. So if you're able to get hyperfixated on jujitsu, even if it's done recreationally, like even if you only train a couple hours a week, but when you're there, you're fully locked in. And if you have a few hours in the weekend to watch instructional, so you're doing that so you can be a better student, I would say then it presents itself as a strength, right? So that could be like an example of a juxtaposition where something in society is a weakness, but in jiu-jitsu maybe is a good thing.
I don't want to burst your bubble, but I really think that a lot of neurodivergent people don't have like sort of a group. Right. And so when you go to that room and it's like a whole bunch of people, yeah, and it's like belonging, right? Yeah. I think that's the number one thing of like any club, anything like that. Even like, you know, like you see these people who are like flat earthers and there's a convention of flat earthers and you look at it, it's just a whole bunch of people who don't belong anywhere else. Yeah. And I hate to be that guy, but like it feels that way sometimes, where people are just looking for a place. Like I said it in the testimony too, like, having friends, like, and meeting the people who are, like, really cool and really nice, I think that's part of it that's, like, makes jiu-jitsu so much more fun. Because it's, like, as a martial art, it's, like, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. As a, you know, like, as a way to, like, take your brain away, put the focus, it's amazing. But, like, having the friends, having the people, like, basically having this conversation right here, or going to another gym and just, like, clicking right away with people you've never met just because you have that in common, really makes it in a way that becomes more than just the martial art, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, like, a social thing. It's a community thing, right? And I think that's what you know, going into, like, movement art, what is movement art, right? Like, I've heard you say this in other podcasts, but you guys wanted to build a community, right? And that's like what makes it more than just any other gym, right?
No, so I would agree with that 100%. And if you were to look at the social cohesion aspect of it as like the driving factor, I would probably agree with you. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to attempt to burst that bubble, but just playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
If that's a reason for people, you know, who are maybe felt like they never had a community, they're now confronted with this community that gets their foot through the door, right? Mm-hmm. But
what keeps them?
Do you
like think that somebody who's like, you know, higher level, who's been doing it for like 5-6 years, right? Mm-hmm. And on, I think definitely you start getting into, you know, there's that obsession, mm-hmm. right? You have to crack the code.
Because you felt it yourself, right? Yeah. Like, you, 100%. Like, there's this, you know, and going back to what you said about movement art being a community that me and Danny intentionally created to be a certain way, it's the environment where I'm watching, you know, people who do it recreationally get obsessed over problems in jiu-jitsu. For me, that's the vibe. That's the community that I wanted to create. I wanted jiu-jitsu to be something that everyone can enjoy beyond the physical aspects.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, the fact that me and you after a class can just talk about, you know, our rounds and maybe what we did wrong and we're troubleshooting things that we can maybe do better the next time. Like, that's the community I wanted to create. So for you to say, you know, maybe you came initially for the community, but you stayed.
Well, I didn't for an come aspect for the community, but like in some ways, like I think that's what, you know, I see, especially like in the lower levels. Yeah, like, but like, what makes, you know, going back to, you know, the right size of like strength and autism, right? Like, and all this stuff.
Yeah,
there's definitely that aspect of like, you know, people who are good at it have that obsessive. Mm-hmm. You know, mentality of we're like trying to solve the problem, trying to crack the problem. It's and that problem can be as small as like, you know, your body position is just a little bit off, 100%. Or, you know, like finding, you know, like if you put your hand through the legs and grab the other leg, you're locking them down so then that you can go ahead and switch that. It's like those little things that's like really, really cool. Yeah. Like for me, it's like anytime like you guys like show something or like make a move, like seems so intuitive, it's like, oh, like it's in the text threads, right? Like with all the other people, it's like, dude, so like Danny just showed me this one thing that like that blew my mind, you know, like, and it's like it's one of those things that you really get you excited, gets you that dopamine of like, oh my god, I'm solving the problem, right? Same thing, it's like work, getting stuff done, you know, you get that dopamine of like, I solved the problem, right? And in jiu-jitsu it's like endless, because you have this sport that you can learn, and it's like as you're learning, same thing in technology, I think, right? Like you cannot just like learn how to code one thing and go a whole career doing it unless you're maybe in finance and still doing, you know, like this old program because they refuse to move on, mm-hmm. right? But like for the most part, technology changes, right? Mm-hmm. So you're always learning something. You're always chasing what's the newest, greatest thing, right? So there's a correlation there. And I've seen this in jiu-jitsu, so many things. I've compared jiu-jitsu with like chess and everything, mm-hmm. right? But like in technology, there's so many correlations of like, you know, it's always evolving. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's only for the people who are really good at it are the people who can problem solve. Mm-hmm. I've seen people who graduated with computer science, horrible at it. Mm-hmm. I've seen people who became a mechanic and then started coding, amazing, mm-hmm. right?
Because that's the fundamental
problem solving.
That's the underlying principle that carries through. So it's interesting that you say that. So jiu-jitsu, right, is constantly evolving. The same way, like you're saying, coding constantly evolves. It's interesting because there was a debate recently between these two guys in jiu-jitsu, and one of the guys were arguing for this idea that there is like this idea of an ideal technique, which basically contradicts everything that we're talking about right mm-hmm. now. Problem solving, right? That principle that you're talking about, that relies on the idea that you're always searching for ideal, even though ideal doesn't exist. So maybe people who don't have that habit of problem solving or don't have the desire to problem solve, maybe it's complacency on their end. Maybe they just accept the techniques or, you know, however you're defining technique of positions and options. Maybe they're just complacent and they just accept the options they have mm-hmm. and they find those options adequate and they don't care about evolving their technique to a point where their game is optimizing at a constant rate.
And that's the same thing, right? Like mm-hmm. you can have somebody who learns a technology, or you can have somebody who learns, you know, goes to this school and learns just the moves and accepts it as it is. It's like, maybe they're going up the ranks. Maybe they're doing that, but they're not growing, mm-hmm. right? Like in their jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. They're just like, kind of like it's almost like the people who went through school and just like memorized all the answers yeah. and got good grades.
Yeah.
It's like, how long is that going to last? Because that's not going to last long, right? Like, or you know, as soon as like the question changes, you don't have the answer anymore. Mm. Right. And it's really like going back to, you know, what you said is there's also that debate of like the ecological approach mm-hmm. versus, you know, like whatever learning, framework. Whatever yeah. other framework, right? So explain a little bit, what is ecological approach?
Yeah, so I would say ecological approach is this idea, or it's this framework for understanding decision-making, right? Mm-hmm. Which is based on the idea that you perceive, you know, things in the environment, right? Opportunities in the environment, and you act upon those opportunities. And that's what's influencing decision-making. And so it's this idea that decision-making relies on your relationship with the environment and how you're, you know, functioning in this environment versus decision-making relying exclusively on whatever memory or mental model you have for that decision, right? So the difference would be like, you know, so like the opposite of that would be like information processing, right? Where you have a controller and, you know, whenever you want to do an armbar, you press X and you do said armbar. And then ecological dynamics approach would argue you're not going into your brain and pressing a button. You're seeing the opportunity for an armbar because you evolved to be able to perceive that opportunity and then you act upon it and do an armbar.
But the training aspect of it is like, here's a shape, solve the problem kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And everything that we're talking about, mm-hmm. it's almost like, oh, that's the way, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's like, but it doesn't really work that way, right? Like, and I'll give you a quick example of this because It was kind of funny. So last Saturday, I have the guys over here at training, and we're drilling something, and we're like, man, every time I get into that position, it's really hard for me to get this frame onto the shoulder. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what's another way? And we thought, it's like, okay, well, if you frame the crook of the elbow here and, you know, like get this leg in, you know, and all the stuff. And we were troubleshooting this, like, all right, now let's go live from there. Mm-hmm. You know, now let's try it this way. Mm-hmm. Now this, and it's like, and we only saw like one thing that it's like, okay, if they do this, it might not work, but everything else seems really legit. And we're like, man, yeah, we're geniuses. Yeah. Let's record this, yeah, you know, everything like that, right? Yeah. Like, and we go to Danny, and Danny just like murders it, and like all this like, stuff that you worked just came in. It was like, yeah, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I love the way that you guys do it, because you guys approach it differently. You guys approach it in a way of like, here's a problem. Mm-hmm. Here's, you know, the solution to the problem according to what we've been doing.
100%.
And here's why it works, mm-hmm, right? And we go into like body positioning. Mm-hmm. We go into, well, you know,
that's
like
the key word is body positioning. And I think this is such a missing piece of just jiu-jitsu teaching in general. Like, even when I get an instructional from, are we good on time?
No, I'm just checking.
Yeah. Go. When I get an instructional from one of the most prestigious coaches, I fail to see them explain body positioning in a way where the position itself makes sense biomechanically, conceptually. And what ends up happening is they compensate for a lack of body positioning by systematizing options, but it's still just a database of moves, yeah, that you're learning. They're never teaching the position itself, how it stands on its own two feet, and how the position in itself is a strategy to force your opponent into what we say are probable outcomes. My whole stance on the eco, so we can agree that static drilling, mm-hmm, out of context is dumb, right? And I've been to those schools where they teach a knee cut. They're like, all right, you do this, drill it 100 times, and you do it on a lifeless partner. It's terrible. And I would say that that's a waste of time. But then you have this new camp of people who are saying that, you know, we can use constraints to make, you know, preferable movements kind of emerge out of the environment, which I understand the sentiment, but I do feel like it's still just extreme on the other end.
And, yeah.
And one thing I've learned through my experiential walk of life is that hardly is anything ever one extreme or the other. There's, you know, everything operates on a continuum, and your best bet is to kind of go towards the middle and implement aspects of both. That's what I find to be the best. And that's something that we try to do with movement art. It's like, of course you need to learn how to adapt the position in a dynamic way. And that's why we do a lot of, you know, situational, positional sparring, whatever you want to call it. But we also understand that there's heuristics, right? There's information that you can relate back to outside of what's going on in front of you, mm-hmm, when you are rolling. Like, and, you know, I don't think this is something that can be debated, right? Like, you've experienced it, I've experienced it. When we are rolling, something happens and we refer back to an instance in our memory or in the past, similar to the situation we're confronted with, and we can remember a positive outcome when we did something. And so we just defer to that solution that we've done in the past,
yeah,
and it works again. And so why not teach that, right?
Yeah.
If the argument is that it will arise naturally, why not shortcut that and just give you that solution as information that you can access outside of what you're perceiving in the moment?
Yeah.
I feel like that's fine. And I don't know why this is a very controversial,
I don't know, but like in going back to technology, right? Yeah. And I think I told you this before, but there's a similar kind of approach in coding too. Mm. So you can code the thing, give it to somebody, they can test your code according to whatever acceptance criteria there are, right? Mm. There's this other approach that says, here's all the acceptance criteria, go code it according to these acceptance criteria. And somebody does that, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe they'll find an edge case or not, you know, come back to you, fix it, done. Then there's this whole nother approach that says, no, we're going to build all the tests now, and your code has to pass that test. Mm. And it peeps me to no end. And there's like high-end companies that go by that model that says, you know, like, man, like, I remember a friend of mine interviewed with Microsoft, and, you know, like becoming a developer at Microsoft is like one of the top level things that you could do in a career, like be part of that. But they asked him, like, how would you approach this? And he's like, well, I would write this and that. And then, like, basically I would write my test cases after. And he didn't get the job just because of that answer. It's like, man, everything else was good, but the fact that you don't do test-driven development, you're not part of
this.
So
there's a bias built into the test.
There's a bias thing.
Wow.
And this is like high level. And same thing with like a lot, right? Yeah. There's really high level people who might do jujitsu who do this approach.
Yeah.
But I've also heard it said, it's like, nah, they were good at jujitsu before they started the ecological in the first place. Well,
so, you know, the reason for that is because ecological training is built into the fabric of jujitsu. We've always done, for as long as since I was a white belt, we did positional sparring, and we've done constraint led approaches, such as, you know, you're going to start in side control, you know, person on bottom is only allowed to shrimp and hip escape and bump you off. They're not allowed to do anything afterwards. Your goal is to stabilize and control them using these underlying principles. That's always existed.
Yeah.
So I think the issue is, if this is a methodology that's supposed to influence how coaches coach, why do we need to concern students with all this terminology? Like, if students are just going to show up at your gym and get better at jiu-jitsu, then why are we talking about stuff that they don't need to know? All this jargon and literature, intensive research that you're citing just to make a point is just irrelevant to the common student.
And it can work, but it's not, for sure, doesn't mean that it's probably, like, for me, I find, like you said, like basically learning the moves is like one aspect of like learning, right? And then it's like applying it to maybe your drills, applying it to, you know, to your roles, and then it's like top level would be competition, right? Like, it's a competition. But for me, like, since I started helping out with the kids now, it became like such a hack for me, like, in a way, because it's like I see a position and I'm like, I can correct that kid or tell him to do the right reaction to that position, and then when I see it in my roles, I can call back to me talking that in, and it's like it's like, oh, you know, like, I literally was just saying this. So it's like, boop, boop, you know, and it became like such a thing. Like, the other day, it's like my son, who likes to like pressure in and all this stuff with his knee onto the frames, like, he was going against Ryan, and I just told Ryan, like, okay, like, knee torque reaction, right, of the De La Hiva. And do you know knee torque? He's like, yeah, go knee torque, right? And it's like, boop, boop. He took the back, everything like that. And I'm like, awesome. Then it showed up in my role. And I'm like, oh, knee torque reaction. You know? It was like, even though, like, I know many times when going into roles, right, like, we get that 100 white thing. And it's like.
And that's why I'm going to make maybe a controversial statement here. I'm sure people who are complete nerds about this have probably their criticisms of it, but I really do think it's just a battle of semantics. Now, I'm not saying that there's people who absolutely are dogmatic when it comes to drilling, but I do think that even eco people will concede on the idea that, you know, explicit instruction, right? Instruction from a coach, that is something that you can reference when you're rolling. I feel like that's indisputable, right? Everyone has had conscious thoughts while they're rolling, mm-hmm. and they're referencing back to this verbal instruction. And now the argument being, is that you picking a move and doing it, or is that you seeing an opportunity in the environment and acting upon it? That's the semantic part. Who cares? You don't need to know how your body learns to incorporate or integrate movements into your repertoire skill for you to be good at jiu-jitsu. You just simply need to do the jiu-jitsu. And that's why criticism of ego, like mm-hmm. even if your framework is 100% true, it's not helping anyone actually get good at jiu-jitsu, mm-hmm. understanding those things, right? Because at the end of the day, you're going to have to still design practices, and your students are going to have to be a testament of your good coaching skills or not.
And if anybody questions, like, how good is your approach? I mean, like, to me, like, your students are, you know, the proof in the pudding, right?
We've had students like, who became world-class athletes in a matter of years.
Yeah.
Right? And so whatever criticisms you have of that approach, it functions at a rapid rate, without a doubt. So, I don't know, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way that I at least I look at it. I mean, going into this, you know, starting jiu-jitsu and starting, like, even from the beginning, like, we got recommended for Alejandro to start first. Mm-hmm. And we got recommended by a friend who was doing jiu-jitsu, and now they quit. But, like, basically they were like, these guys are, like, world-class athletes. They got people coming from all over the the country to come train with them and all that stuff. And it's like, man, it's like right down the street from me.
That's crazy.
And it was like, man, this is really cool. Yeah. So it's like we started just off that, right? Yeah. And then I started training. And it's like, but the point being that is like the proof is in the pudding, right? Like your students are like, you know, really making waves out there in the community. Like you have like world, you know, podium holders at both brown, you know, like, and black belt with Danny, like at some points, you know, like there's tons in that you just have to say, okay, well that that's why. So with that, I know like you definitely have your goals in what you want as a competitor. How do you, what are your thoughts on balancing that versus balancing being a coach, being a business owner, being a
that, you know, going back to our conversation about managing tasks.
Sorry to give you anxiety.
My brain is like Six Flags. So like you said, when you are, so, you know, those of us, or those who don't know, you're helping us coach the kids program, and you just gave an anecdote about how coaching someone in the class even benefited your own jiu-jitsu, because you were able to see something and then reflect on that something when you were rolling yourself. And so I do think there is this relationship between coaching and being an athlete that helps each other, right? Coaching gives me a more intimate relationship with the jiu-jitsu I'm doing, which benefits me as an athlete. And then me being an athlete, competing, making mistakes, figuring out what I could do better to optimize my game, feeds back into coaching so that I can better coach you guys. Like we said, you know, techniques evolve. This is indisputable. And the same techniques that we are teaching in class today are not the same techniques that we were teaching, you know, a couple years ago. You know, everything's becoming more refined. And because of this positive feedback loop, I feel like being a coach and being an athlete is compatible. Now, what's not compatible is, you know, understanding that you have a limited amount of time and feeling that sometimes there are going to be spans of weeks or months even where one responsibility takes away from the other. An example of that would be like, you know, getting ready for Worlds. You know, that's like 6 weeks where I take off my coaching hat and I put on my athlete hat, and maybe my responsibilities as a coach suffer a bit, right? And I, and you know, not to say to an extent where the students, it's like palpable, and the students are like, man, like I'm not getting coached. Like I still believe we do a good enough job where we try to be there for everyone, and we are actively helping the community as a whole get better. But to say that there isn't a drop in attention as a coach would be lying, right? So I think for me, it's just balancing those two things out and learning how to best optimize one role when I am most committed to that one role. So when I'm, you know, this month I'm not competing, so I can be a coach, really doubling down and being a good coach, versus the times that I know I'm going to have to take resources I would be giving students and giving them to myself, you know, having to be more selfish, you know, doubling down and doing that. And, you know, I think that's just the reality as a business owner, as a coach, and as an athlete. There's no perfect way of balancing that out. You just have to do the best job you can.
Yeah.
But it's not easy, you know, and for sure, having Danny as a co-owner of the business, someone who also coaches and who is also a high level athlete, but managing those responsibilities between each other is huge. Cause I know a lot of people try to do the same. Like an example would be like, you know, like a Lucas Lepre in his prime, you know, JT Torres. These are guys who operated gyms, who were athletes and coaches, but may not have had a co-owner who they can share those responsibilities with. So I can't even imagine that extra responsibility, right? So I would say that I'm sitting in a comfy spot where even if things get really hard for me, I can lean on someone else to kind of take some of that burden off of my shoulders.
Yeah.
But
that's definitely helpful.
Yeah. And it's not easy.
No, I can't imagine. And then also there's a business aspect of it, right? Because then it's not just like you open a gym, you get people in, and I mean, thank God for Mama Freestyle, right? Like,
let me take a moment to give her a shout out. I try to do this as much as possible every podcast I do. I try to shout out Mama Freestyle. For anybody who doesn't know, that's Danny's mom, and she's literally the backbone of the business.
She is.
Because not only is there a lot of back-end stuff that people don't even know with like owning a business like jiu-jitsu, there's so many little things that you have to be on top of. So with us having these responsibilities and us having ADHD on top of it, it really, really pays to have someone like Mama Freestyle, who is as, you know, punctual as she is, as attentive to detail as she is. So wherever we slack, she really like picks it up and does her job really well. Like, you can't put a price on what she does.
And a true black belt at that, too.
And a true black belt at that.
So even on the mats, I mean, she's amazing.
But I think that's what a business should be. I think a good business owner is going to look at their strengths and weaknesses and make sure that they're honest with themselves and say, okay, these are my strengths. I can do these tasks myself.
Yeah.
But wherever I'm weak, I can delegate to someone.
And that's huge to even... Like, for you to get there, or for you guys to get there, it's huge. Because a lot of people, like, they get, like, almost too much pride to say, I can't do this on my own, right? And I need help. You know, especially, once the ego, you start stacking on that, like, people who are, like, high-level athletes, you know, like, basically, it's huge.
And I've seen a lot of gyms just have too many chefs in the kitchen and the whole thing just falls apart because it becomes something so far removed from functional. It's just a bunch of people expressing their egos. And I've seen a lot of businesses come and fail as a result of that. I feel like at least with movement art, everyone knows their plays. Everyone knows their strengths. Like, for example, you know, Danny is not the best with technology, right? Whereas I'm a little bit more technological aware just because, you know, growing up, I was really into like producing music and I was like a Photoshop nerd. So I know how to like navigate like software and things like that a little bit more. So what do? Whatever tasks rely on technology, I take up those tasks. Mm-hmm. Danny is a little bit better hands-on with certain things. So whatever tasks are a little bit more handy, he takes those tasks on. So it's finding that balance and not allowing ego to get in the way and admitting like the areas in which you're good, areas in which you're bad, and like working together. Right?
But even like you said, like you're good with Photoshop. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, it might have been like all you on the marketing side,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
But now you're man enough to say, you know, it's like, man, we need help on this and hire somebody else who's like. Whose sole focus is that, right?
Exactly, because they can do it better.
So it's like, it's amazing that to have that as a person. So just kudos to that.
Thank you. And I appreciate it. But it's also like so relieving to, so the Squarespace website, I did the best I could with the resources that Squarespace gives you. And I created the Movement Art website. And then, you know, we hired Sean, and now Sean goes on the website and he gives us a list of, hey, I can improve all these things, SEO, you know, keyword tagging.
Yeah.
I can make the website look more functional. So he's improving the user interface aspect of it. I'm like, yes, because there's no way I could have done all these things. Yeah. So it's like such a relief to have someone who's an expert in whatever they do be able to take on those responsibilities. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Dude, that's really cool. So what about like competition? What's next for you? I mean, you have Worlds every year.
Worlds. And so, all right. So this is the idea. I'm going to throw this out there right now, but it could just not actually come to fruition. So I've been a black belt for 4 years. And my goals those 4 years were to win a Gi IBJJF title.
Mm-hmm.
So in those 4 years, I invested all my time and energy into the IBJJF circuit. You know, between getting points to qualify for the majors and competing at the actual majors, you know, I invested a great deal of resources and time, and, you know, sad to say, but fell short in those 4 years. So this year, I'm actually going to change my strategy. Rather than putting a great deal of my intention on IBJJF, I'm actually going to do a lot more AJP. And I want to do a lot more no-gi super fights. So I'm actually going to be kind of changing my strategy for the competitions this year. I'm probably still going to do Worlds 100%, but it's going to be debatable how many IBJJF events I'm going to do this year. Just because every year I tell myself I'm going to do something different, and then I just kind of fall back to the same game plan. And I've done that for 4 years now, and the results have more or less been the same. So I just want to try something new this year. I'm very realistic. I'm only getting older every year. To be honest, maybe competing at an adult level, maybe 3-4 more years. So I really want to maximize my shots at different things and kind of diversify my competition. So I'm looking to travel a lot more this year. AJP does offer cash prizes for their winners. So that's a benefit, something that IBJJF currently doesn't really do outside of like specific events like the Grand Prix. So, and this is something I did at Brown Belt. So at Brown Belt, my focus was a lot more on AJP, and I kid you not, and I tell people, like, what, like, really? So as a Brown Belt in AJP, the year before COVID, so 2019 to the beginning of 2020, I probably made close to 10 grand. As a brown belt, which is great. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. And since then, I've probably spent 10 grand on IBJJF tournaments as a black belt. So I think just coming to the realization that, you know, if I can only do X amount of tournaments this year, what are we going to do that's different? And I think the answer I came up with was this. So I'm going to do a lot more AJP. So there's an AJP coming up in Rome and in London. I plan to do at least one of those. And yeah, let's see if we bring different
results. So that's something that's like definitely brought more light into it due to like CJI offering $1 million and all that stuff, amazing. Right? Like amazing stuff, but like getting the athletes to pay.
Yeah.
So has that always kind of like, besides obviously wanting to survive, has the thought of like getting paid competing been in your mind, you know, when
as I'm getting older
and
as my responsibilities grow, so like I just bought a house last year, yes, so the idea of making money has definitely taken a priority in my decision making going forward. So like with IBJJF, you know, a lot of times you're paying for your own registration and you're competing on your own dime. And even if you win, you don't make any money, right? So it with the circumstances changing, I'm not like a broke 25-year-old anymore who's just happy to get prestige. You know, like at 25, my goals were a lot different than they are now, or my life was a lot different than it is now. So I think it's normal to have your goals and your strategies to accomplishing those goals to change. And like you're saying, with CJI now offering money, and then that just raising the bar across the board for all competitions, because competitions are seeing that and they're like, okay.
Even Naga came out and said like $1,000 on like
they have to adapt, because right? If these opportunities exist, people are going to be investing their resources to attend those tournaments. Yeah. So why not also join and be an opportunity for people? And we see that happen, like you said, with Naga reintroducing the prize brackets back into the competition. I think this is an amazing thing, because at the end of the day, if these competitions want to attract the highest level competitors want to get paid. And we want to make money off what we're doing. So I think it's just a natural byproduct of everything that's happening. There's the professionalism of jiu-jitsu increasing, which means there's more sponsor money, there's more competition money, and all these organizations are competing against each other to attract these competitors. So it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, like I said, I'm saying this now. Who knows? Maybe my ideas change. Maybe I'm just like, hey, you know, let's just do pans, you know, let's just do it, you know. But the way I think of it is like going back to our conversation of the coach and athlete dilemma. I have to be particularly picky with the time that I take away from being a coach and the time I invest in competitions. Because ideally, I would do all the competitions, but then I'm not going to be able to coach. So realistically, one a month, one every other month is a probably the most ideal strategy. So I have to be particular with which ones I do. So right now the strategy is AJP, Nogi Super Fights, where I'm getting paid, and then everything else is secondary.
So that's the personal aspect of it. I want to ask you, like, how much does it affect you when your athletes are going out there, whether world stage or local comp, you know, and all the stuff and doing well?
So I get more satisfaction and pleasure in seeing my students succeed than I do myself. And that works also on the other end, where I get more nervous for my students and I get more disappointment when I see them fall short of their goals, because I see how devastated they are and I see how hard they work for these goals. And when they lose, it feels like I'm losing as well. So for me, so I'll set the record straight. I enjoy coaching more than I do competing. So, and I think that gives context into this conversation. If I had to choose one, I would choose coaching. What makes jiu-jitsu enjoyable for me is problem solving, like we talked about, and seeing other people reach their goals and helping other people in that process. So coaching for me is the priority over being an athlete myself. So when I see my students go out there, for me, that's the most satisfying experience as someone who's participating in jiu-jitsu. Seeing my methodology manifest through this person's performance and seeing them like, oh, hey, like, look at Jimmy doing that sequence I showed, you know, the other week. Like, you know, I don't have kids, you know, but I would imagine that's the closest thing to being proud of your son or daughter as it can get. Without actually having kids.
There's a picture of like Alejandro's in his first competition.
That's probably the craziest experience. Right. Like, it's not only like your student, but it's also your kid.
Yeah. Right. And there's a picture of us like after the comp, and you can literally see like the tears in my eyes almost like welding up. And it was like such a pride. He like basically, he lost every side, right? Like, but the amount of pride that I got, like from him just basically saying, I want to compete, to getting out there, to actually like doing multiple brackets and everything like that. But like and the amount of like from each fight he got coaching, right? Like, okay, you need to do more of this, you need to do more of that, blah blah, you know, and all that stuff. And I saw him implementing that into every, and it's like, man, it was his first competition, you know. Yeah, you know, it happens. He got people who are like better at faster at computing than he was. You know, whatever, dude. I was the proudest dad ever. Like it is such a like great picture that I have, And it really, like, basically resonated with me because it's like, man, there was one thing that our friend Steve said to his kids that really made an impact. And he said, you know, like, win or lose, we're going to go for pizza anyway for afterwards. Right. And it really, like, and I said the same thing to my son. I stole that and I said that. And like, man, that's really like a great feeling.
Dude, you have no idea how amazing, how refreshing that sounds because, you know, as a coach, I've seen all types of, you know, parent-student relationships. And you do have that occasional parent who's like, if you don't win, no Xbox tonight. And that breaks my heart to hear that the parent is prioritizing this tournament so much that they're willing to punish their kid for doing poorly, something that's completely out of their control.
Yeah.
You know how many matches I've lost that I'm like technically better than the person, but they're better at competing. They're better at strategizing. They're better at gaming the system than I am.
Or just counting.
Yeah. Or just counting. Yeah.
Sweep.
Yeah. Which one am I on? So imagine placing that kid's or that person's self-worth on a performance, because that's basically what you're communicating when you punish them or you prevent them from enjoying a certain something as a result of their poor performance. It's you're basically attaching their self-worth to the performance. And, you know, people who listen to this who aren't familiar with, you know, the jiu-jitsu world, it's unfortunately very common. We call them like helicopter parents, and I know they exist in all sports, but I feel like jiu-jitsu is a different animal because of the nature of jiu-jitsu being this physical thing where essentially you are trying to harm your opponent. You're trying to break their limbs. You're trying to choke them out, and it's on them to tap, right? So that's the theory behind it. You are trying to harm them, and so to go to these tournaments and hear how these parents communicate and coach their kids. I've heard all types of horrible things. I've heard, you know, Johnny, break their arm, just break it. And, you know, poor Johnny, you know, has to hear his parents not only coach in a way that that portrays jiu-jitsu in this, like, very, you know, hyper aggressive way, but I bet you poor Johnny is not going to be able to play Xbox if he doesn't win that match. Yeah. And it's just the amount of kids that are just growing up in this relationship with jiu-jitsu is just horrible. And it's very common. I've seen it both as an outsider and an insider. And, it's horrible. So to hear that relationship and that experience you had with your kid, and hearing, you know, Steve was his name. Yeah. And what he said to his kids, like, that's amazing, you know? So we need more of that.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, and I think part of it is also that we train also, right? It definitely, like, has that aspect of, like, we know what it takes to do that, right? I heard a story, and I won't name names, but basically the dad is, like, you know, being, like that, even just on a training floor, let alone a competition floor.
And
another dad who trains just sits down next to him and says, "No, have you trained before?" Says, "No. Would you want to try it?" "No, not really." "Well, it takes a lot, you know." And the guy got quiet and is like, "Don't be so hard on him. Like, it's very hard to do what he's doing." And that was like, whoa.
That's like an awakening, right? To hear it from a parent that also does a sport should be sobering to that person. But yeah, you're aware of the amount of parents that we've had come through the doors who've never trained, who undermine our coaching. And
I want to end this not on a rant note, but like on a good note. Let's do a little we listen and we don't judge moment here.
Okay.
So my we listen and we don't judge moment was a white belt took my back and I ankle locked him by wrapping my feet around his cross feet and putting on it, knowing that he wouldn't know that that doesn't work if he
I love it. I think we need more of that. Yeah. I think you should teach. Sometimes you have to teach the person through action versus than words. I feel like it's like the idea of touching a hot stove.
Yeah.
It's like, I think there is a credence to allowing someone that you care about to kind of make a grave mistake, like touching a hot stove, so that they can learn the importance through that experience rather than just telling them. So sometimes you tell someone, oh, don't touch the hot stove. It's not enough. I feel like the lesson doesn't really penetrate their soul. So I feel like, I feel like what you did was a great justice to the jiu-jitsu community.
What are some of the things that you remember as a lower belt? Like basically cringe moments of your, you know, just starting out. It's like, man, because I think we all have, right? Like, I definitely had my fair share of them. Mm-hmm. And like looking back at like people who come in new and they're just like, you know, they think they have the answer, or they come with this different mentality, and you're just like sitting there like, man, like.
So when I was a white belt, my coach at the time, David Lenz, he was a karate guy who was also a black belt of jiu-jitsu. And we had an Aikido professor, whatever, come in and basically say that jiu-jitsu doesn't work. And me and another student, Chris Ulbrich, the owner of Garden State Jiu-Jitsu, were both in the class at the time. I was a teenager. I was like 13, 14 years old. Chris must have been 17, 18 years old. And Mr. Lentz, our teacher, says, hey, you two, roll with this guy. And I'm like, okay, I'm a kid. I'm going to listen to my coach. I'm going to roll with this condescending, pretentious Aikido master who claims that jiu-jitsu doesn't work. And I kid you not, with maybe 4 or 5 months of jiu-jitsu experience, to this day, I haven't recreated how badly I was able to overcome this guy through submissions and everything. But I think for me, what I observed was this idea that people are going to always allow ego to dictate how they perceive the world, regardless of martial arts background, regardless of experience. And so I guess the cringe factor for me is like, you have to, I don't think what my teacher did at the time was defendable. I would never do that now. I would never be like, oh, this guy doesn't know any better. Let's smash him. But I think going forward as a kid, you realize like, this is no way to operate in the world. So I think lessons like that teach me, you teach yourself how to conduct yourself in the world from experiences like that. So I just remember thinking, I never want to be that guy. I never want to be the Dunning-Kruger know-it-all that just walks into a place and thinks that they know everything and thinks that what they're participating in doesn't work. So I would say that's probably one of the most cringe experiences I had, because I partook in the dismantling of this person's worldview, but I also had to like see that worldview melt in front of my eyes, and being a kid and seeing
reciprocate the thing that you told me. You did a good justice there. No, but like with that, I want to end with one more recommendation of a book. Ego is the Enemy is one of the greatest book that I've written, that I've read. And it really puts it into perspective, because no matter whether you do jiu-jitsu, whether you do anything else or just go about life, you know, ego is the enemy is a true statement that you shouldn't let your ego take over.
I like that, because it's the idea that you could potentially be your own worst enemy if you allow something like an ego to be the driving force behind your actions. So noted. I'm gonna read the book.
Thank you so much for coming today.
And obviously, like, this is not going to be the first, it's the first, but it's not going to be the last time. Hopefully we can coordinate more of these conversations and we can talk about all types of things. Like, and hopefully people enjoy this conversation, everything from caffeine to, you know, what it's like to own a gym and, you know, everything in between. So, yeah. And, you know, let us know if we do this again, what you want us to talk about. We're always open to suggestions. If you want to follow Movement Art, we have an Instagram, Movement Art Jiu-Jitsu. You can follow me at That Nick Salas. Sometimes I post controversial things on there, but most of the time I'm just posting boring jiu-jitsu stuff. So if you're into that sort of stuff, be sure to follow.
And also That Nick Salads is really great Instagram if you like food.
Yes. Right. We're getting back and we're working on it. We're back. Dude. We're back to being consistent on That Nick Salads.
It's so good. it's probably for me, like it is way better than the other one. Jiu-jitsu. So, like you see me when I like the thing is usually food related. It's like
you're like more. All right, of this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, bro.